were often really serving as prostitution clubs, the San Francisco Police Department decided to take action. They sent out letters to a couple dozen strip clubs and warned them that the police would be looking into their activities. They would be checking their business licenses and making sure that their permits were up to date. The police action caught the attention of newly installed District Attorney Kamala Harris, and her staff sent the message to hold off on the enforcement. Meanwhile, in response to continued complaints, the police conducted a pair of sting operations. Three undercover officers went into each of the two clubs and were quickly solicited by female employees for paid sex. At both the Market Street Theater and the New Century Theater, it happened within minutes. When the operations were done, nine women were arrested, as was the general manager of the New Century. The cops claimed that they were slam-dunk cases, but Kamala Harris dropped the cases. "It just leaves me in amazement," said San Francisco Police Department Vice Captain Tim Hetrich. "It was almost legalizing prostitution." Publicly, Harris claimed that the problem was that the police should be focused on arresting street-level pimps and johns. In a statement, Harris claimed that there had been no arrests of either. The San Francisco Police Department was incredulous. "That's an outright lie," said police investigator Joe Duto. "There were 50 to 70 johns arrested every month." Harris then argued that the problem was that the doors for the private booths at the clubs were not legal and that the Department of Building Inspection should deal with them. Ken Harrington, a top building inspector, fired off a snarky memo requesting the very precise parameters of the job they were to do to satisfy the DA. Apparently flabbergasted that his office was responsible, not the cops, he stated, "The next thing she'll be blaming the gunshot homicide rate on us for not enforcing the city's lead abatement ordinance." Harris's strange objections to prosecuting prostitution cases connected to these raids have a possible explanation. The owner of both the Market Street and New Century Theaters was a company called Deja Vu. An owner of Deja Vu, Sam Conti, had a long history with Willie Brown. Conti had first hired Brown as his defense attorney back in 1977. They remained friends. At Conti's 2009 funeral, Brown delivered a videotaped eulogy. Harris's handling of this simple vice matter would set up questions about her prosecutorial conduct as it related to powerful political allies and friends. While she was prepared to throw the book at those with no connections to her, those with links to her or her powerful allies would often get charges dropped. It was selective enforcement of the law, hardly what one could call blind justice. Kamala Harris entered the San Francisco Attorney General's office facing a whole host of issues beyond priest sexual abuse and strip clubs. Among them was the rampant corruption that had become so common under her ex-boyfriend and political sponsor, Willie Brown. During the bitter campaign, Terrence Hallinan had publicly stated that Harris would be unwilling to bring corruption charges against allies and friends of Willie Brown because they were still too close. Her record as a prosecutor would prove him correct. Willie Brown appointed Hector Chinchilla, a real estate lawyer, as head of the San Francisco Planning Commission shortly after he became mayor. The Planning Commission has enormous power in San Francisco in determining which projects proceed and which do not. Chinchilla, sensing an opportunity, hired himself out as a consultant to developers who were seeking city planning permits from his commission. Over the course of the next several years, he took in $181,000 from developers. The corruption case seemed clear. Developers told city officials that they had been told that if they hired Chinchilla, he would run interference regarding opposition to their development. Reportedly, Chinchilla performed anything needed on the project. In 2002, then-prosecutor Terrence Hallinan had charged Chinchilla with seven misdemeanor ethics laws violations. "We do regard it as a major corruption case and indicative of what is going on in San Francisco," he said at the time. "It is very disturbing that that kind of atmosphere is pervading in San Francisco." Given how close Chinchilla was to Willie Brown, the case roiled City Hall. Barely 8 months in office after a judge dismissed some charges, Harris dropped all remaining charges against Chinchilla. It would not be the only case of Harris dropping the criminal charges of a Willie Brown ally. Even in instances where fraud directly threatened public safety, Harris struck legal deals with the friends and allies of Willie Brown. Consider the case of Ricardo Ramirez. Ramirez ran a cement and concrete company called Pacific Cement. As of 2003, a full one-third of the public works projects in San Francisco used Pacific. Ramirez was a colorful but ruthless player in the construction business. He liked to wear $500 cowboy boots and roamed around the city in a $100,000 Mercedes-Benz. He threw lavish parties with mariachi bands and tossed around a lot of campaign cash. Having given almost $100,000 to politicians over the previous 8 years made him a well-connected political player in San Francisco. Those contributions often went to the Willie Brown machine and were not always legal. In 1997, state officials found that Ramirez had illegally contributed $2,000 to Brown's 1995 mayoral campaign. His ties to Brown went beyond financial contributions. Ramirez was reportedly friends with Brown, but he also hired connected officials like Jim Gonzalez, who worked as a lobbyist for Ramirez. Longtime Willie Brown buddy Charlie Walker was also a close friend. Ramirez might have gone down in the annals of San Francisco political history only as a contractor greasing palms to get city contracts, but he also cut dangerous corners, threatening San Francisco public safety. Ramirez was using inferior and cheaper recycled concrete on major projects like the Golden Gate Bridge, parking garages, and light rail projects. These were massive projects where structural integrity was key. The half-mile stretch of the Bay Bridge's western approach, the parking garage at Golden Gate Park, a wastewater treatment plant in nearby Burlingame, and the Municipal Railway's Third Street Light Rail project. The projects required solid concrete, but Ramirez was actually using inferior recycled concrete, which contains recycled debris rather than hard rock. Prone to water penetration, recycled concrete is more likely to crack and to wear quickly. Recycled concrete is acceptable for decorative work, but for major load-bearing projects like roads or bridges, it is considered unsafe. Ramirez's company was able to keep up the scam for a while, but it eventually caught up with him. Public works agency officials went public with the fact that Ramirez's company had defrauded them. Strangely, Ramirez never faced charges for delivering substandard concrete. Instead, Harris's office settled for a plea deal involving a single environmental count, illegally storing waste oil at one of his production facilities. To avoid jail time, he agreed to a year in home detention and payment of $427,000 in fines and restitution. City officials were mystified. Tony Anziano, an official with the state agency Caltrans who was in charge of the Bay Bridge Approach Project, said the agency had been defrauded by Ramirez and his company. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, Anziano said that Caltrans had always cooperated with prosecutors and that he couldn't explain why they hadn't pursued charges. Harris and her office refused to offer an explanation as to why they were going so light on Willie Brown's friend and donor. Harris's office had no explanation for why it dropped the concrete case, noted the Chronicle. Kamala Harris's signature program as San Francisco District Attorney was called Back on Track, a program designed to give first-time drug offenders an opportunity to avoid a criminal record. If they participated in and successfully passed through the program, their drug record was wiped clean. Harris would tout the program as enormously successful. Back on Track is an innovative initiative that has achieved remarkable results, she said in 2009 as she prepared her run for California Attorney General. It has dramatically reduced recidivism, the reoffense rate, among its targeted population, nonviolent, first-time, low-level drug offenders. She boasted that fewer than 10% of Back on Track graduates in San Francisco had reoffended, but those numbers were highly deceptive in that they only reflected who graduated. During the first 4 years of her program, for example, they kicked out almost half of those chosen for the program. The real recidivism rate was likely much higher. The program was also fraught with other problems that Harris was hoping the public would ignore. Those included were not just nonviolent first-time offenders who had committed a single drug offense. Some were illegal immigrants and violent criminals, such as Alexander Izaguirre. Izaguirre had gone through the program even though he had two arrests instead of just one within 8 months, one for selling cocaine, the other for purse snatching. Given those facts, it is unclear how Izaguirre even got enrolled. More, Izaguirre was one of at least seven illegal immigrants who were signed up. The problem was that the job training program that Harris had enrolled him in was training him for jobs that he could not legally hold given his immigration status. One night, while he was still in the program, Izaguirre went to San Francisco's exclusive Pacific Heights neighborhood and committed a particularly brutal crime. Amanda Kiefer was walking down the street when Izagiri snatched her purse and jumped into a waiting SUV. Rather than drive off, the SUV sped toward Kiefer to run her down. Kiefer jumped on the hood and saw Izagiri and the driver laughing. The driver slammed on the brakes, throwing Kiefer to the ground. The impact fractured her skull. Blood was oozing from her ear. Kiefer would later ask why he was even in the program. If they've committed crimes and they're not citizens, then why are they here? Why haven't they been deported? Harris did not offer an explanation. Instead, she simply explained that enforcing federal immigration law was not her job. Never mind that her oath of office required her to enforce the laws of the state of California and to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. Harris has a habit of dealing with problems by covering them up. In 2009, Harris set her ambitions higher and announced her bid for California Attorney General. She enjoyed the backing of the San Francisco establishment, Willie Brown, and won a very tight 2010 race against Republican Steve Cooley, who was the Los Angeles County District Attorney at the time. In the end, Harris won by fewer than 75,000 votes, or less than 1%, out of more than 9.6 million votes cast in the election. The pattern of selective enforcement of laws continued during her tenure as Attorney General. Beyond the move to Sacramento and the new job, Harris also became romantically involved with Los Angeles attorney Douglas Emhoff. The two met on a blind date set up by a close friend of Harris. They were engaged in March 2014. By August, they were married. It was a private ceremony presided over by her sister Maya. Guests were sworn to secrecy. Emhoff has practiced corporate law most of his career and specializes in defending corporations facing charges of unfair business practices and entertainment and intellectual property law matters. He established his own boutique firm in Los Angeles, but was later tapped to become the partner in charge at the Los Angeles office of Venable LLP, an international law firm with offices around the country. As partner in charge, Emhoff was involved in all cases coming out of the office. Venable's clients included a parade of corporations who had matters sitting on Kamala Harris's desk. The fate of many of those cases is further evidence of the selective nature of the way she has exercised power, often for the benefit of friends, family, and those with whom they have financial ties. Nutritional supplement companies have faced a myriad of legal actions over the years about what critics claim are exaggerated statements about the effectiveness of their products. This would seem to be a natural area for Harris to use her powers as Attorney General and as a self-professed consumer advocate. Indeed, in 2015, the Attorneys General from 14 other states, including New York, launched an effort to investigate nutrition companies on the grounds of false advertising and mislabeling. They claimed many products contained ingredients that were not listed on their labels and that could pose serious health risks. Harris, who had a history of working with these AGs on other issues, did not participate. At the same time that these states were pursuing the nutritional supplement issue, the Obama administration's Department of Justice, or DOJ, was also going after dietary supplement producers, charging them with exaggerated claims about their products that are unsupported by adequate scientific evidence. Their targets included General Nutrition Corporation, or GNC, Herbalife, Advocare International, Vitamin Shoppe, Walgreens, and others. The Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, opened an investigation into Herbalife in March 2014. In California, Harris's Attorney General's office had received more than 700 complaints about Herbalife. In July 2016, the FTC won a $200 million settlement against Herbalife. But Harris never even investigated the company. Something very strange occurred in this instance when it came to Harris's handling of the matter. The Los Angeles Times noted her conspicuous failure to participate in the action. It is worth noting that those corporations in question all happened to be clients of her husband's law firm, Venable LLP. GNC, Herbalife, Advocare International, Vitamin Shoppe, and others were represented by Venable. Indeed, her husband's office had only months earlier, in January, represented Walgreens in a case involving false advertising claims. Though the lawsuit was dismissed, the possibility of another class action case remained. Herbalife was one of Venable's large clients, paying the firm for thousands of hours of legal work. Herbalife had been the subject of a standing court order since 1986 concerning its advertising claims and practices. Critics point out that Harris declined to enforce those standing court orders. As Harris was deciding on how to deal with the Herbalife matter, the company's lobbying firm threw her a fundraiser. On February 26, 2015, the Podesta Group, which specifically represented Herbalife, held a luncheon fundraiser for Harris in Washington, D.C. In 2015, prosecutors from Harris's own Attorney General's office, based out of San Diego, sent her a long memorandum arguing that Herbalife needed to be investigated. They also requested additional resources to probe further into the company and its practices. Harris declined to investigate or provide the resources, and never offered a reason. By August 2015, Venable LLP promoted Emhoff to managing director of the West Coast operations. This was not the only case in which Harris exercised her prosecutorial powers selectively. Those with the right connections avoided legal scrutiny even in generally clear-cut cases. Governor Jerry Brown was a Harris political ally and endorsed her candidacy for the U.S. Senate. Brown's sister, Kathleen, joined the board of Sempra Energy in June 2013. In 2015 and 2016, the company suffered the biggest methane gas leak from a well blowout in U.S. history. For more than 100 days, gas streamed out of the company's well. The culprit was a corroded metal lining that had ruptured after long-term exposure to groundwater. It was a major environmental failure by the company. As Attorney General, Harris often took on environmental cases with gusto. In this case, Harris's office refused to investigate the matter. Political power creates leverage opportunities when a politician wants something from someone. The Daughters of Charity owned several hospitals in California that were struggling and at risk of being shut down. The charity wanted to sell those hospitals to another nonprofit chain in the hopes of preserving them to serve the local communities in which they were based. The matter required a simple approval by California Attorney General Kamala Harris, as required by state regulations. A powerful union, United Healthcare Workers West, or UHW, threatened to blow up the deal by offering to support her bid for the U.S. Senate if she would stymie the sale, and further, threatened to spend it on an opponent if she would not. Founded in Paris in 1633, the Daughters of Charity is dedicated to serving the poor. By the 19th century, the order was in the United States and eventually began opening hospitals. As of 2002, the Daughters of Charity Health System, or DCHS, consisted of six California hospitals. The system found itself in difficult financial conditions in 2014. The charity was facing serious economic challenges in the changing world of healthcare. The nonprofit hospital chain had suffered an operating loss of $146 million, so they opened up the sale of the hospitals for a competitive bidding process that lasted 13 months and brought in more than 200 bids. Daughters of Charity selected a bid from Prime Healthcare Services for $843 million. The choice was simple, as Prime Healthcare's was the only bid that promised to honor a $250 million unfunded pension for 17,000 current and former employees, maintain the facilities for at least 5 years, ensuring that communities would not immediately close money-losing hospitals, commit $250 million in capital expenditures, and maintain the existing union contracts with employees. Prime Healthcare had a history of good performance in these circumstances. Over the previous 15 years, they had acquired 35 hospitals around the United States that were either bankrupt or in deep financial trouble and had managed to save every one of them. As California Attorney General, Harris spent lots of time deciding which legal cases to bring and how to defend the state in court. She also had a role in providing regulatory approval, which meant, of course, leverage over companies. One of her regulatory responsibilities was the Nonprofit Hospital Transfer Statute, which meant she needed to approve such transactions as the Prime Healthcare acquisition of Daughters of Charity. Not only had the Daughters of Charity Hospital voted in favor of Prime's bid as the best and only option to keep the hospitals open, but also a broad coalition of groups supported Prime Healthcare's proposal. The California National Organization for Women and the California State Conference of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, supported the bid. So, too, did newspapers like the San Francisco Chronicle and the Los Angeles Times. Indeed, the California Nursing Association, or CNA, which represented 90,000 registered nurses in California, came out in support. But powerful political allies of Harris's did not like the deal. In particular, the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, UHW's parent union, was strongly opposed. The union was a longtime backer of Harris, and she coveted their support as she looked to run for the U.S. Senate in 2016. During her 2010 and 2014 elections for Attorney General, SEIU and UHW had donated more than $204,000. In 2014, they were her leading campaign contributor. They also provided millions more through political action committees. Executives involved in the deal heard that the SEIU was promising Harris $25 million through SEIU COPE, the National Political Action Committee, if she squelched the deal. SEIU leaders hated Prime Healthcare. The nonprofit chain had a good working relationship with many unions, including the California Nurses Association, but SEIU was not among them. SEIU wanted full unionization of all of Prime's California hospitals. They also wanted to unionize the nurses under their UHW, but the CNA already represented the nurses at Prime. Public hearings were held in the affected communities by Daughters of Charity, and there was overwhelming support for the sale of DCHS to Prime. But the nonprofit chain refused SEIU's demands. According to a lawsuit filed by Prime Healthcare, SEIU officials boldly told the head of Prime Healthcare that unless they allowed their union to take over representation of the nurses, Harris would not approve the deal. If true, it was an extraordinary statement from union officials. They would dictate the regulatory approval of the transaction. Prime Healthcare also alleged that Harris's office informed advisors for DCHS that the Attorney General would approve the deal only if Prime allowed SEIU, UHW to unionize the chain. The Daughters of Charity ended up filing a lawsuit against the SEIU-UHW, accusing the union of extortion. The Prime Healthcare complaint against Harris claimed that on February 20, 2015, Harris publicly approved the transaction, but put impossible conditions on the deal. These were essentially poison pill requirements that her office knew would not be approved by Prime Healthcare. Indeed, the list of 300 conditions was 77 pages long. Furthermore, those conditions were non-negotiable. The Attorney General of California had never imposed such conditions on a hospital sale before. The consultant that Harris had brought in to review the deal had not suggested these conditions, according to the complaint. Indeed, senior executives from Harris's office allegedly informed Prime Healthcare that the conditions were from the Attorney General herself. This was not the first time Harris had allegedly blocked a deal involving Prime Healthcare, which claimed that back in 2011, SEIU officials took credit for getting Harris to block Prime Healthcare's acquisition of Victor Valley Community Hospital, or VVCH. Although the independent consultant hired by Harris's office had allegedly recommended approving the deal, the Attorney General said no. Instead, the complaint alleged that Harris wanted Victor Valley Community Hospital to support a bid by a competitor, KPC Global. She placed no conditions on the KPC Global purchase, even on fees or reimbursements, even though VVCH was a nonprofit hospital. When Victor Valley Hospital board members protested the decision, Harris allegedly threatened them with criminal investigations from her office and possible termination from the hospital board. SEIU leaders bragged to hospital executives about their power. On July 24, 2014, union boss Dave Reagan told Dr. Prem Reddy, head of Prime Healthcare, that as long as the nonprofit resisted his efforts to unionize the hospitals, there would be no Prime Healthcare deals in California. He allegedly told Reddy that Harris was his politician and she would do what he told her to. For the Daughters of Charity deal, SEIU favored a strange alternative, which, as alleged by Prime Healthcare, demonstrates where their interest actually stood. They did not push for a nonprofit chain like Prime Healthcare to take over the charity hospitals. Instead, they pushed for a New York City-based investment fund called Blue Wolf Capital Partners. The private equity firm had zero experience in operating hospitals. What they did have was close ties to organized labor and the Democratic Party. The Blue Wolf deal never materialized, but Harris had other ideas. Having squelched the purchase of a nonprofit hospital chain by another nonprofit chain, Harris then jumped and offered conditional approval for Blue Mountain Capital to manage the hospital through one of its subsidiaries. The deal was quite extraordinary and, frankly, bizarre, even though, unlike what Prime Healthcare had proposed, it would maintain the hospitals as nonprofit entities. Blue Mountain Capital had a hard-charging reputation in financial circles and had been neck-deep in the credit swap debacle back in 2008. And in this particular case, Harris was approving a deal that was far worse for patients, according to Prime Healthcare's complaint. She allowed Blue Mountain to cut services that Prime Healthcare had promised to keep open. For Prime Healthcare, she had said that women's health services were required to remain open, for example, something that Prime Healthcare said it would do. Harris was allegedly allowing Blue Mountain Capital to close such services. Harris's approval of the purchase was remarkable. "I cannot recall a hedge fund incursion of any scale, let alone on this scale," said Richard B. Spahn, a partner in the law firm Nossaman LLP's healthcare practice. "It's anomalous and it's portentous in sort of an ominous way. The monetization of non-profit assets in this fashion is worrisome." Blue Mountain Capital is headed by Andrew Feldstein, who has donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democratic Party. His wife, Jane Varon, is also a major donor to the party, contributing tens of thousands of dollars. Harris has used her powers as a prosecutor to leverage her rise to power and protect corrupt allies and friends, but sometimes leverage is exercised through the proxy of family. 3. Joe Biden. Gritty Joe Biden from Scranton, Pennsylvania, has been part of America's political life since 1972, when at just age 29, he was elected to the U.S. Senate. America watched Joe Biden bury his first wife and daughter following a tragic automobile accident right after his election and shortly before Christmas. America's heart went out to him again as Vice President Biden buried another child, son Beau Biden, when he died from brain cancer in 2015. Joe Biden has been on the stage, sometimes in a lead role, in every major national political drama since Watergate. As he recounts in his memoir, "As a United States Senator, I've watched and played some small part in history. The Vietnam War, Watergate, the Iran hostage crisis, the Bork nomination, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the reunification of Germany, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, 9/11, two wars in Iraq, a presidential impeachment, a presidential resignation, and a presidential election decided by the Supreme Court." Although not as ideological as some, he has largely remained a progressive Democrat to his core. To any American paying attention to politics, Biden was a familiar figure even before becoming Barack Obama's choice for vice president in 2008. In part, this was because he had served as the longtime chairman of two powerful Senate committees, Foreign Relations and Judiciary. So, as Selena Zito notes, we really have seen Biden's career unfold on television. At least we have seen the television-friendly portions of Joe Biden's political career unfold. Other aspects involving his family's complex and obscured international deals leveraged on Joe's political status and power have rarely been explored. The Biden family partners are often foreign governments, where the deals occur in the dark corners of international finance like Kazakhstan, China, Costa Rica, Jamaica, Ukraine, and Russia. Some deals have even involved U.S. taxpayer money. The cast of characters includes sketchy companies, violent convicted felons, foreign oligarchs, and other people who typically expect favors in return. Joe's public power positions Biden family members for highly lucrative deals they likely would not otherwise get. These deals also often occur with the appearance that Joe Biden has done favors for the partners who welcome such family members. These are not a few disparate enterprises, but rather money-making ventures that appear to be part of a well-organized family business. Joe Biden has insisted in absolute terms that he never discusses family members' business activities. The Biden family's apparent self-enrichment depends on Joe Biden's political influence and involves no less than five family members: Joe's son Hunter, daughter Ashley, brothers James and Frank, and sister Valerie. When this subject came up in 2019, he declared, "I never talked with my son or my brother or anyone else, even distant family, about their business interests, period." As we will see, this is an impossibility. Biden's political identity rests on his hardscrabble and humble roots, which create the impression that both he and his family are not interested in money. As one admiring newspaper man puts it, "Biden sweats humanity. Still, he does not necessarily like pedestrian labels. I am always labeled as the middle-class Joe," he groused in 2014. "In this town, that is not a compliment. It means you are not sophisticated." The Bidens started out in blue-collar Scranton, Pennsylvania, but in the face of financial hardship, moved to Delaware when he was still young. After first attending the University of Delaware and then law school at Syracuse University, he jumped almost immediately into politics. By the age of 27, Joe was running for Newcastle County Council in Delaware. From that beginning, Joe's political career was a family affair. His younger brothers, James and Frank, organized a volunteer army of young people who worked the strong Democratic precincts. When he ran for the U.S. Senate just 2 years later, James, then just 22 years old, was his finance chairman. His sister Valerie was his campaign manager. She would go on to lead every one of his political campaigns over the next 3 decades until his vice presidential run with Barack Obama. From his earliest foray into politics to the present day, Biden's political life has been fused with his family. From the beginning, the Biden family, as one admiring biographer puts it, formed the nucleus for Joe Biden's political operations. The notion of family was deeply embedded in the Biden psyche at an early age. "The single best thing I learned from my father is," Joe's son Hunter once said, "family comes first, over everything." This otherwise admirable character quality crosses the line into corruption when political position and vested power become the locomotive of the family money train. Love of family is not a legitimate excuse for the abuse of power. The 1972 run for the U.S. Senate was pivotal. Young and little known, Joe was elected to the Newcastle County Council just 2 years earlier. That made him an unusual commodity. In a 1974 interview, he described his situation in terms that he now probably regrets. "I'm like the token black or the token woman," he explained on the PBS program The Advocates. "I was the token young person. I'm a 29-year-old oddball. The only reason I was able to raise the money is that I was able to have a national constituency to run for office because I was 29. Biden was remarkably candid in that interview about raising money and his willingness to prostitute himself to do it. "You run the risk of deciding whether or not you're going to prostitute yourself to give the answer you know they want to hear in order to get funded to run for that office," he explained. "I went to the big guys for the money. I was ready to prostitute myself in the manner in which I talk about it, but what happened was they said, 'Come back when you're 40, son.'" Despite those early struggles, Biden was able to raise $276,000 for the Senate campaign, a significant sum in 1972 for an election in a small state like Delaware. Much of the coordination work was done by his brother James, who as finance chairman worked to enlist the support of national unions, political leaders, and financiers around the country. Joe's opponent was Congressman J. Caleb Boggs, a two-term Republican incumbent for the state of Delaware. He was a World War II veteran who had earned endorsements from labor. In 1972, Joe beat him, winning a close election by 3,000 votes out of 230,000 cast statewide. Thus began his 36 years as a U.S. senator until he became vice president. Weeks after his 1972 electoral victory and entrance onto the stage of national politics, tragedy struck when, as mentioned earlier, his wife and daughter were killed in a car crash. His two sons were injured. His sister Valerie moved in to help with his boys, Hunter and Beau. Joe would commute home to Delaware from Washington almost every day on Amtrak to be home with them. Riding the rails would become a powerful symbol of six-pack Joe. According to Biden, he has made more than 8,000 trips on Amtrak, although not always in the commuter car. "I can say this now, since they can't do anything about it. I used to ride in the cab a lot with the engineers. If he was running late, Biden pulled rank. On many days, he would call the train conductor and the train would be held until Joe came aboard. Other rail commuters would just have to wait." The clouds parted in Joe's personal life a few years later when his younger brother Frank gave him a phone number and suggested he call a girl named Jill. The two had met at school. "You'll like her, Joe," Frank said. "She doesn't like politics." Joe and Jill quickly became serious, and it was clear that this was going somewhere. The family noticed, and brothers James and Frank took her to dinner for some straight talk. "They told me," Jill later recalled, "it was a dream of this family that Joe would be president, and did I have any problem with that?" The dinner was a testament to how the family viewed its fortunes as being tied to Joe's political rise. Clearly, Biden's political career was very much a family operation. In 1988, when Joe was running for president, he looked to be a favorite. But his campaign was derailed by allegations that he had plagiarized a speech from British politician Neil Kinnock. With the campaign in crisis, his wife Jill, brothers Frank and James, sister Valerie, his parents, and his children all gathered around Joe. The choice to withdraw from the race was a family decision. A Catholic priest married Joe and Jill in 1977 in a ceremony held at the United Nations Chapel in New York City. They had a daughter, Ashley, in 1981. As the kids grew, they moved into a mansion once owned by the DuPont Company in Greenville, Delaware. For the next three decades, Senator Joe Biden became a Washington fixture, accumulating a progressive voting record on a wide variety of issues. Other aspects of his voting record suggest the pull of his family's commercial interests. Senator Biden pushed for the passage of a new bankruptcy law that put him out of step with most of his Democratic Party colleagues. He voted against a bill that would require credit card companies to provide better warnings about the perils of making only minimum monthly payments. He was only one of five Democrats to do so. During the same period, between 2001 and 2005, son Hunter was receiving consulting fees from the MBNA Corporation, a major Delaware bank and credit card company. While sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Biden also worked hard on legislation to deal with asbestos damage lawsuits. It just so happened that son Beau was working for a Wilmington, Delaware law firm that was handling asbestos litigation cases. In 2001, son Hunter jumped in with both feet when he became a lobbyist with the firm Oldacre, Biden & Belair LLP, with offices on Connecticut Avenue just blocks from the White House. Their founder, William Oldacre, also served as a legal advisor to Joe Biden. The boutique firm specialized in appropriations lobbying, which meant shaking money loose from the federal government for their clients. They represented lawyers, American Indians, as well as the healthcare industry. It was located in the same office as the national group lobbying firm, also run by Oldacre, whose clients included the University of Delaware. Part of their job was submitting targeted spending items called earmarks to Biden's office. The arrangement seemed to work quite well until 2006, when the Senate passed an ethics bill requiring senators to verify in writing that they or their families would not benefit from spending items or earmarks that they were pushing. Hunter had to shift gears and leave the appropriations lobbying game. However, Hunter was not done with other types of lobbying. An online gambling company run out of Gibraltar named Party Gaming was under federal scrutiny. The Department of Justice had issued subpoenas to more than a dozen banks working with the company. The company needed help in Washington and hired Hunter Biden to lobby on their behalf. It probably did not hurt that his father was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a senior member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, with oversight of the Department of Justice. In 2008, Hunter eventually dropped his lobbying clients when his dad was announced as Obama's running mate. Months later, a co-founder of Party Gaming pleaded guilty to violating the Wire Act and agreed to pay a $300 million fine to the U.S. government. During his years in the Senate, Biden's family benefited financially in other ways as he leveraged political power. Joe's sister Valerie ran all of his Senate campaigns as well as his presidential runs in 1988 and 2008, but she was also a senior partner in a political messaging firm named Joe Slade White & Company. The only two executives listed at the firm were Joe Slade White and Valerie. The firm received large fees from the Biden campaigns that Valerie was running. $2.5 million in consulting fees flowed to her firm from Citizens for Biden and Biden for President Incorporated during the 2008 presidential bid alone. Keep in mind that Joe Slade White & Company worked for Biden campaigns over 18 years. When Barack Obama selected Joe Biden as his running mate in 2008, it boosted the Biden family fortunes to another level. Now, suddenly, there were opportunities on a global scale. The executive branch offered an abundance of power to leverage, and the value of the Biden family's commercial deals, especially those of Hunter, James, and Frank, would skyrocket. With the election of his father as vice president, Hunter Biden launched businesses fused to his father's power that led him to lucrative deals with a rogues gallery of governments and oligarchs around the world. Sometimes he would hitch a prominent ride with his father aboard Air Force Two to visit a country where he was courting business. Other times, the deals would be done more discreetly. Always, they involved foreign entities that appeared to be seeking something from his father. Often, the countries in question, including Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan, had highly corrupt political cultures. In short, Hunter Biden was not cutting business deals in Japan or Great Britain, where disclosure rules and corporate governance might require greater scrutiny. These were deals in the truly dark corners of the world. In 2009, Hunter established a series of small investment vehicles with his friend and business partner Devon Archer. Biden and Archer had been at Yale University together. They launched Rosemont Seneca Partners in partnership with Rosemont Capital, an investment vehicle backed by the Hines family. Chris Hines, stepson of then-Senator John Kerry, had been roommates with Archer at Yale. Clearly, this would be an extremely well-connected firm in Washington, D.C. As I recounted in my previous book, Secret Empires, on December 4, 2013, Hunter was riding on Air Force Two with his father to Beijing, China. For Vice President Joe Biden, effective diplomacy was about forming personal relationships with foreign leaders. It all gets down to the conduct of foreign policy being personal. The Vice President had a series of important and tense meetings with Chinese officials on a variety of critical matters in the bilateral relationship. The trip coincided with an enormous financial deal that Hunter Biden's firm, Rosemont Seneca, was arranging with the state-owned Bank of China. What Hunter did during the official visit to Beijing, we cannot know for sure. Other than a few photo ops with his father, he was nowhere to be seen. After the publication of Secret Empires, Hunter Biden, through an attorney, claimed to ABC News that he did no business during his visit to Beijing aboard Air Force Two. However, a Beijing-based BHR representative later claimed that Hunter had introduced his Chinese business partner, Jonathan Lee, to his father during the visit. Approximately 10 days after the Beijing trip, Hunter Biden's Rosemont Seneca Partners finalized a deal with the Chinese government worth a whopping $1 billion. The deal was later expanded to $1.5 billion. As of this writing, the fund's website says its investments amount to more than $2 billion. It is important to note that this deal was with the Chinese government, not with a Chinese company, which means that the Chinese government and the son of the vice president were now business partners. What they created was a joint venture called Wuhai Harvest RST, or BHR. The name reflected who was involved. The RS was a reference to Rosemont Seneca. The T was the Thornton Group, a small U.S. investment firm that did business in China. It was a very unusual arrangement. The most powerful financial institution in China, the Bank of China, was setting up a joint venture with Rosemont Seneca Partners. BHR touted its unique Sino-U.S. shareholding structure, as well as the fact that it was backed by the Chinese government. Hunter Biden actively cultivated these deals. He had visited China twice before, in 2010 and 2011, to meet with senior Chinese government officials in finance. But he had no background in China, and other than a very brief and unsuccessful attempt to run a hedge fund with his uncle, no background in private equity. When the Chinese government's BHR was established, Hunter Biden was given a slot on the board of directors, supposedly unpaid while his father was vice president. His actual compensation cannot be known. It is confidential. Since Secret Empires was released in 2018, Hunter has claimed that he only received compensation from the Chinese after his father left the vice presidency in January 2017. He further claimed it came in the form of a 10% equity stake in the Bohai Harvest Financial Management Company. Whether his claim is accurate or not is impossible to know. It cannot be independently verified. Furthermore, he has misled reporters about the Chinese deal in the past. Even if his account is accurate, that his compensation was deferred, it does not really make a difference. Deferred compensation from a Chinese government entity is still direct compensation from a Chinese government entity. He has never explained why he got this great opportunity from the Chinese government in the first place. BHR, with Hunter Biden on the board of directors and Devon Archer as the vice chairman and investment committee member, engaged in a series of financial deals that served the strategic interests of Beijing. In one of their first deals, the firm took an ownership stake in China General Nuclear Power Corporation, or CGN, a nuclear energy company in China. The company was charged in 2016 with espionage against the United States. Also charged was an engineer who stole nuclear secrets from the United States. BHR also helped buy out the American precision machining company Hennigs. They bought the company in a joint deal with Aviation Industry Corporation of China, or AVIC, a military contractor owned by the Chinese government. Because Hennigs technology has military application and therefore national security implications, The deal had to be approved by an interagency committee made up of Obama-Biden administration officials. BHR also invested in military-related technology companies closer to home. They bought a stake in Face++, a major developer of facial recognition software commonly used in a phone application made by the Chinese government for surveillance of its own population. BHR was the first of a series of business relationships that Hunter Biden established with the Chinese government or Chinese government-connected entities. Another Hunter Biden-linked firm called Rosemont Realty struck a deal with a Chinese government-connected company in 2014. Hunter was an advisor and the co-founder of the company, which owned commercial real estate properties around the United States. Just as he had little or no background in private equity, Hunter also had no background in real estate. Rosemont Realty openly touted its ties to Vice President Joe Biden. In a Rosemont Realty Company prospectus for investors watermarked confidential, there was the key consideration that Hunter Biden, son of Vice President Biden, is on the advisory board. Better yet, Rosemont Realty had other political connections beyond Hunter Biden. Rosemont Realty was headed by Daniel Burrell, a Yale grad who had worked on the John Kerry 2004 presidential campaign. A major investor in Rosemont Realty was an entity called Rosemont Real Estate GP, LLC. Who exactly owns Rosemont Real Estate GP is unclear. However, in Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, filings, the firm lists its address as that of the Hines family office in Pittsburgh and shares a phone number with Rosemont Capital in New York City. At the time of Rosemont Realty's arrangement with the Chinese firm, John Kerry, married to Hines heir Teresa Hines Kerry, was the U.S. Secretary of State. Just about a year after the massive deal with the Chinese government's Bohai Harvest, another Hunter Biden firm struck a pact with another Chinese government-linked firm called Gemini Investments. This deal involved a multi-billion-dollar investment with Rosemont Realty. Who exactly is Gemini Investments? While Gemini is a publicly traded stock in Hong Kong, it is ultimately an indirect subsidiary under the control of a Chinese conglomerate called Sino-Ocean Group, formerly Sino-Ocean Land. Gemini Investments director and honorary chairman is Li Ming. His corporate and political ties in Beijing go to the highest levels of the Communist Party. Indeed, he served several terms running as a member of the Chinese Communist Party's elite People's Political Consultative Conference. Before the name change, Sino-Ocean Land was one of the largest real estate companies in Beijing, and it is directly connected to a company called China Ocean Shipping Company, or COSCO. Formed in 1961, COSCO is a state-owned company with strong organizational links to the Chinese Navy. By December 2014, Gemini Investments inked the new partnership with Rosemont Realty, under which they would acquire an interest in the company and its underlying properties. 8 months later, the newly christened Gemini Rosemont announced its plans for $3 billion worth of new acquisitions. In short, Hunter Biden was involved in $2 billion deals with Chinese government-connected firms in a 20-month period while his dad was Vice President of the United States. Hunter was apparently eager to strike other deals with the Chinese, business implicitly leveraged on who his father was. Consider the case of Patrick Ho, who was arrested in late 2017 by federal agents in New York for money laundering and violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Ho was an assistant to Chinese oil tycoon Yi Xianming, who ran the energy company CEFC. The company has strong ties to the Chinese military. Hunter Biden would later admit Yi sent him a large diamond after one of their meetings. Biden says that he did not keep it. Ho was also the Secretary General of the China Energy Fund Committee, which many observers view as a government-directed entity. In March 2019, Ho was jailed in the U.S. on bribery charges stemming from oil deals in Africa. According to the New York Times, it appears that Ho's first phone call while in the custody of U.S. officials was an attempt to reach Hunter Biden. CEFC officials had met multiple times with Hunter Biden beginning back in 2015. In May 2017, Hunter met with Ho in Miami, where they reportedly discussed joint energy and infrastructure deals in the United States. The night of his arrest, Ho called James Biden, Joe's brother. Why Ho had James Biden's number is not clear. According to James Biden, the call was a surprise. He believed Ho was trying to contact Hunter, so he gave him his nephew's number. During Ho's trial, prosecutors presented evidence that he was an arms dealer on the side, running guns to conflict zones around the world. He was sentenced to 3 years in jail. If, in fact, Ho did intend for his first call while in custody to reach the son of the former vice president, it speaks volumes about how juiced Hunter Biden was in the world of Chinese officials. With Hunter's deals in China, Joe Biden's attitude toward China seemed to soften. In 2011, the Obama administration announced a strategic shift called the Asia Pivot. Based on the idea that the main military and strategic challenges facing the United States are emanating from China, the Obama administration shifted military resources toward Asia. Yet Biden continued to strike a relatively soft posture toward Beijing, much to the chagrin of U.S. allies in the region. He continued to minimize the challenges posed by China in the spring of 2019 while on the campaign trail. "Come on, man," Biden said. "They're not bad folks, but guess what? They're not competition for us." Hunter Biden's foreign deals were not limited to China, as strategically generous as that country was to the vice president's son. Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and even Russia offered him other wealth opportunities. Ukraine boasts an abundance of energy resources, especially oil and natural gas. Burisma, a top Ukrainian natural gas producer, has deep political ties in the country. It was created in 2006 by Mykola Zlochevsky and has a Cypriot registration. He became the ecology and natural resources minister under the pro-Russian government of Viktor Yanukovych. As natural resources minister, Zlochevsky conveniently gave himself licenses to develop abundant natural gas fields. His oversight allowed Burisma to become the second largest private natural gas company in the country. They currently rank first. As previously noted in Secret Empires, on April 16, 2014, Devon Archer made a private visit to the White House for a meeting with Joe Biden. The day prior, Burisma had deposited more than $112,000 into a Rosemont bank account marked Care of Devon Archer. 6 days later, on April 22nd, it was announced that Archer was joining the board of directors of Burisma. In short succession, on May 13th, it was announced that Hunter Biden would join the Burisma board too. Neither one had any background or experience in the energy sector, or in Ukraine for that matter. We now know, based on financial records, that each man appears to have been paid $83,333.33 per month by Burisma, or a total of $1 million a year. The timing of their appointment to the Burisma board and the payments is more than interesting. The day before Archer's official appointment, on April 21st, Vice President Biden landed in Kiev for meetings with Ukrainian officials, bringing with him terms for a United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, program to assist the Ukrainian natural gas industry. Even in a country abounding with corruption, Burisma stands out. Burisma founder Zlochevsky was in legal crosshairs when Biden and Archer joined the company board. By February 2016, Ukrainian authorities seized Zlochevsky's property on suspicion that he was engaged in illicit enrichment. Zlochevsky found himself on Ukraine's wanted list and fled the country. The Ukrainian Prosecutor General's office seized Burisma's gas wells. Tax authorities began investigating him for suspicion of tax evasion. Hunter Biden used his contacts in Washington to help Zlochevsky in his corruption case. Burisma hired a former Obama Department of Justice lawyer named John Beretta and Blue Star Strategies, a consulting firm run by former Clinton administration officials, to help. Beretta would later recount how he interacted directly with Ukrainian prosecutors with the expressed purpose of getting the charges dropped. According to Beretta, the charges were dismissed in September 2016. Under pressure from Joe Biden, Ukrainian officials fired the Ukrainian prosecutor who was investigating Burisma. Joe Biden later bragged that he had the prosecutor fired by threatening to withhold $1 billion in U.S. aid assistance to Ukraine. On January 16, 2017, Air Force Two descended toward Boryspil International Airport, just southeast of Kiev. It was Joe Biden's last foreign trip as vice president. Under Biden's direction, the Obama administration had poured some $3 billion into the country. 4 days before Biden arrived, Burisma announced that the Ukrainian government prosecutors had ended the criminal investigations into the company and its founder Zlochevsky. There is no complete public record of Hunter Biden's foreign financial deals while his father was vice president, because neither he nor any other members of the Biden family, beyond Joe and Jill, had any federal disclosure requirements of their finances. However, court documents, including financial records from a trial involving Hunter's business partner Devin Archer, offer some tantalizing clues involving other deals Hunter Biden made around the world during the time his father was vice president. A Morgan Stanley investment account from which Hunter regularly received funds shows money arriving from mysterious sources around the world. There is a $142,300 deposit in April 2014 from Kazakh oligarch-controlled Novartis Holdings. Kenis Rakishov, whose father-in-law is the former vice prime minister of Kazakhstan and a close ally of Kazakh dictator Nursultan Nazarbayev, runs the offshore firm. In August 2014, $1.2 million arrived into